Okay, welcome everyone. My name is Scott Shepherd, founder and host of the City's First podcast. We're really excited to welcome one of our most esteemed guests we've actually ever had on the 2 years of this podcast today. Internationally renowned, two-time mayor of Bogota, Colombia, Enrique Peñalosa. Enrique, welcome. How are you doing? You're calling from New York today, I believe, New York City.
Yes, I'm in New York. Hello, Scott. Thank you very
Very
much
good.
for this invitation.
Yes, we're really excited. We have a lot to cover in short time, so we'll kick it off kind of with our normal format, just a brief bio. We'll go through a series of about 4 or 5 questions, kind of themes, and then we'll kind of listen to Enrique about the path forward, as well as where we can find him on social media and his upcoming speaking engagements. So with that, we will get started here. A bit more of an abbreviated bio, but it's quite lengthy, so I'll try to get to the good stuff here. So accomplished public official, economist, and administrator Enrique Peñalosa completed his second term as mayor of Bogota, Colombia in December 2019. While mayor, Peñalosa was responsible for numerous and radical improvements to the city and its citizens. He promoted a city model giving priority to children and public spaces and restricting private car use, building hundreds of kilometers of sidewalks, cycle paths, pedestrian streets, greenways, and parks. After organizing a car-free day in the year 2000, he was awarded the Stockholm Challenge Award and rewarded by a referendum vote by endorsing an annual car-free day and the elimination of all cars from streets during rush hours from 2015 onwards. Peñalosa has also led efforts to improve Bogota's marginal neighborhoods through citizen participation, which involved planting more than 100,000 trees, creating a new and highly successful bus rapid transit system, and turning a deteriorated downtown avenue into a dynamic pedestrian public space. He helped transform the city's attitude from one of hopelessness to one of pride, developing a model for urban improvement based upon the equal access of all people to transportation, education, and public spaces. So I'll take a pause there. Welcome, Enrique. We're very happy to have you.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Okay, let's get started here. So we're going to follow kind of the typical City's First format here. So we have about, like I said, 5 questions, about 5 or 6 minutes per question. If we spend a little bit more time on each question, we might truncate towards the end. But let's start kind of at the
It's
high
fine, yes.
with that here. So the first topic or question I'd like to ask you is just around the built environment. So tell us how Bogota's built environment has evolved during your 2 terms as mayor and since then. So during the 2 terms and afterwards, how has the built environment, public spaces, transformed physically?
Well, it's interesting, important to remember that my first term was in what for many of your listeners may be prehistory, which it was in 1998. At that time in Colombia, practically there was not a single decent sidewalk. There had been some sidewalks built decades before, but there were cars parked on them. Only 10% of the population had cars, but they were the ones with power. I would say the great difference between an advanced and a backward city is quality pedestrian spaces, sidewalks. In developing countries, you see there are cars all over the sidewalks. And in developing countries, only a minority have cars. So there is an equity issue there. The people with cars feel they are more important than those who walk. And so a car parked where on a sidewalk or where there should be a sidewalk is a symbol of insufficient democracy and the lack of respect for those, for people and for lower income people in general. And so it was a war. I was almost impeached for getting cars off sidewalks. I would say there is not one decent sidewalk today in Colombia that existed before my first term. And now there are many happily, but still not enough. I also started doing bikeways when there were no bikeways anywhere. I mean, we did bikeways 10 years before Paris or many years before New York or London. Of course, there were bikeways always in the Netherlands and Denmark and so on. But we did a large project with more than 250 kilometers and even some bicycle highways, like I would say 15 meter wide, 25 kilometer. Now today we have like 120 kilometers of bikeways in Bogota, or of bicycle highways, I mean. Today in Bogota, we have more than a million people using bicycle, more than a million bicycle trips every day, the most there in any city in America. We also did a lot of work in parks in both my terms. Practically was not very few parks in Bogota. We did more than 1,500. I say I got more land for parks than all previous mayors added up together in the history of the city, because this has not been an issue. So these are physical things that we did. There are many other things. The bus transit system, I mean, we took off from Curitiba's example, but we improved radically the
BRT. I was just going to mention Curitiba. Yes, I wanted to talk about it.
But we improved it radically in the speed and the capacity. And this is why our system became a model to more than 300 cities around the world. Today, this, and besides, we innovated even giving it a name. We gave it the name the Transmilenio. The BRT is making it a little sexier. And Transmilenio, and this started a wave. Now many systems have names all over the world. And now this system only has 114 kilometers and moves like 2.5 million people daily. And it's been expanded, actually most of it by contracts we did in my second term as mayor, by about 60%. So it moves more passengers per hour kilometer, or more passengers per kilometer than almost all subways in the world.
Yeah, more than any heavy rail, of course, or even light rail, for that matter. Yep.
We move more than any European subway line, and than any. Only there is one subway line in New York, the green one, that moves this around the same. But they have, it's a two line. It has an express and a local one. Anyway, it's a high capacity, very low cost system.
Low cost, yep.
And of course, subways are fantastic, but simply is too expensive for a city to cover a whole city. Bogota, by the way, for those who are listening, is an 8 million inhabitant city, high up in the mountains, in a tropical region, but Bogota is cool. It's like a fall weather all year round. And we did many other things. We did the schools in the poorest neighborhoods. So of course, we improved. The first time I was mayor, almost there were a very important percentage of the city had informal origins, and so we had to legalize, bring water, bring sewage, schools, pavements. In total, I built more than 67 schools, beautiful schools. By the way, some with very innovative programs where the best private schools would manage those schools. We built some fantastic big libraries that we wanted to be also monuments, like temples that would symbolize that knowledge is important.
Monumental learning, of course, yes.
Yes, learning. The same as beautiful schools in a poor neighborhood, where at that time many did not even have pavement.
Mm-hmm.
A fantastic school like you could find in any private school anywhere in the world. I mean, it's this symbol that children are important, which is not obvious when many children in our culture, in low income, they don't even know who their father is. So it's not so obvious that they're important. And also that education is important, that knowledge is important. And also we construct values. I believe infrastructure constructs values. And by the way, to end this, because I'd like to talk a little bit about my book, my whole philosophy, I just published this book about, it's called Equality and the City. And the whole thing is about equality. For example, the BRT system is an unconscious symbol of equality, because for the first time, public transport users go much faster than those in private cars. When $200,000 car is stuck in traffic and doesn't move, and the bus zooms by next to it, it's almost
they have the priority. Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That's almost a symbol of democracy at work. Mm-hmm. It clearly shows that public good prevails over private interest.
That's beautiful. Yep.
And so it's much more powerful than an underground subway as a symbol.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see the subway. I mean, maybe fantastic, but you don't see it.
You can't see it. No.
You know, it's there, but instead,
it's not tangible. No.
When the expensive car is there and the bus zooms by next to it, a bikeway too was for us an issue of equality. because it shows, I mean, that actually one of the issues of democracy and equality today is how to distribute road space. If all citizens are equal, a citizen who is walking has a right to the same amount of road space that one in a fancy car.
Of course.
Or somebody on a $100 bicycle has a right to the same amount of road space as somebody in a Rolls Royce. And again, a bus with 200 passengers has a right to 200 times more road space than a car with one. So many of these issues have to do with constructing values, unconscious, even the large library. In a country where many times there is a lot of corruption and things like this, or drugs or whatever, much less than people think outside, but anyway.
it's more positive than what we all hear, yes.
Yes, the library is a symbol that what is important is knowledge, not having things. The important person is those who teach, the teachers, the professors, and even a businessman is important, not because he has, but because he knows and can teach. It's a bit like the cathedrals in Europe. They reflected the values of a society. You can see at the what was important in the European society 500 or 600, 1,000 years ago from miles away is the cathedral. What was important was religion. But so the cathedral reflects the values of a society, but also it constructs them. Because once you go into one of these cathedrals in the Middle Age, and in an age where there's not even electricity, and you see this, you become Christian almost.
Mm-hmm.
So again, the libraries and the schools and everything we do in the city is a symbol that constructs values. And so we did many other things, but we don't have time in this question anyway.
No, this is great. Actually, we covered a few questions just in the one. It flowed organically, so that's beautiful. Thank you, Enrique. So next, I want to talk about, I'm going to skip ahead because we did talk about the bike lane network and how Bogota's network became kind of a global model for active transportation. But I'll hit upon those themes a little later. But I want to know, I have my own opinion about this, but I want to get it from you, from the source here. Now, what can North America and Europe learn from Latin American urbanism? Just a very broad question now, because I think that what you mentioned about Paris, we talk about the 15-minute city, we talk about Amsterdam, we talk about Copenhagen, we talk about other U.S. cities taking the limelight and really kind of getting much attention related to, you know, this newfound emphasis on active mobility, especially during and post-COVID. But seeing and hearing and learning about how Bogota has been doing this for decades previously, I would like to flip the script and say, and probably promote exactly what you already do in general, is how can Latin America and the Global South teach Europe and North America better? I'd like to see a lot more of that. I'd like to learn from Bogota. I'd like to learn from Mexico City, you know, Curitiba, Medellin, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I say European cities are fantastic, and some even are, you know, like the Dutch cities are amazing. But of course,
let me rephrase that. What can North American cities learn from Latin America? Let's take out Europe for the equation here.
Yes.
Just what can the United States learn from Latin America?
Again, because Europe. Again, I was going just to say that in Europe, most cities are very small in general, so we have to deal with different challenges. It's much more different to solve the mobility issues in a 200,000 inhabitant city than in a 10 million inhabitant city. But clearly, our cities are compact and dense, too compact and too dense sometimes, because we lack most developing cities lack enough public spaces, space for roads, spaces for parks, spaces for schools. So we lack much of this, but clearly, I mean, I believe this 15-minute city is a nice sounding sentence, but most European cities are 15-minute cities, and our cities are 15-minute cities. It's just a cute sentence, but of course, and many people, of course, have to work in the other side of the city. In Paris, when they built the new cities after the World War II, or even in London, they try to make themselves self-compact, where they will have jobs and housing. But of course, the husband gets a job in the other extreme of the city, and so they stay living there because maybe his wife lives works there, but he has to go across the city to the other extreme to work. So this is a little, in a city, I would say more important than this cute 15-minute city, which of course is what has been, we all agree on. And we have it naturally somehow in Latin American cities.
Organically.
It's for people to be able to go easily to the other side of the city where they have to go many times because they need to go to work or to study or for recreation. So, and so in Latin America, I would say that we have compact cities where people walk to the bakery or to the cafe or and they could be better, of course, because we could have more parks and better sidewalks and better public transport. But the United States, I was just landing in New York yesterday.
Yes, yes, you're telling me about that.
And I saw so many, I remember, I didn't realize there were so many suburbs around New Jersey. And
it's
so
not just Los Angeles with the sprawl. People forget about
that. No.
It's all
New
North
York.
America and Canada, yes. Too. People forget.
Everywhere, yes. And so
Canada has plenty of sprawl.
These are the neighborhoods which are, first of all, they are boring because you don't see people. The most thing anywhere, we like to see people. And in this neighborhood, you don't see anybody.
They're horizontal.
Maybe somebody jogs by, or maybe somebody takes the dog out, but you have to go take the car to go by even some eggs. And maybe now, if you order them by, then you don't even go even for the eggs in the car, you know? So
that robs the sense of community even worse with the 15
so
minute
one thing
deliveries.
That is very bad is for, you know, always we have to design cities for those most vulnerable, for the poor, for the handicapped, for children, for the elderly. And for example, a child, a 10-year-old child in a compact city can move around, can go shopping, can go meet their friends, can go to the playground, can take public transport. They can be 10, 12, 13, 14, that they are independent. And instead, in a suburb like that, a 14-year-old child is like handicapped.
Trapped.
They have the famous story of the soccer moms that the parents, they cannot go anywhere by themselves. And so this is why they, and even after they are 16 and they have a driver license, most of them don't have access to a car. So they're still trapped, even if they are 16. I mean, the very wealthy neighborhoods, they may have access to a car, but most of them don't. And so for the elderly as well, it's very boring to be by themselves trapped. Many old elderly people cannot drive. They wait all week for somebody to take them to the market to do shopping. Some kind soul does this job. But this is extremely boring. They cannot go walk, meet their friends at the plaza or at the park. Also, there is much less variety because if there is not enough people around, so it's very difficult to sustain some things that are a little exotic, like, for example, German philosophy classes or an Afghan restaurant or things like this, because there is not enough customers. You need more of a critical mass of people in more density so that you have different things. So the people who love a certain breed of dogs or any kind of, so that you meet people that like the same things that you like. And the poor, even worse. I mean, the poor have to go far and far and farther to go find a home. So all of these things are a problem. Of course, the suburbs have green. You can see a lot of more green than in dense cities. That's very beautiful and nice. And it's nice to garden, but most people don't do gardening. So they just a chore. They don't even... It's much better to have a park. A park is different. A park is not a garden. A park is a place where you see other people. There are even studies that show that the places where people most stay at parks are those where most people walk by. Because even in parks, people except for some a few times you want to be on your own and without anybody around. Most times you want to be in the park, but you want to see people. And children, always they like to play where there are the most people around. And so clearly, I mean, this has been discussed for a long time, but of course this is also very bad for global warming, because in the suburbs, land is relatively cheap. And so homes are very big. And so you have to spend a lot of energy in heating or cooling, because homes are very, in a compact city, homes are small. So you spend less in heating and cooling. Also in the suburbs, you have to go much longer distances to work or to whatever. So there is a lot, much more energy spent there. Also, there is something that is extremely important that makes this suburban structure even more anachronic today. And that is that households are getting much smaller. I mean, for example, when my parents had like 8 or 9 brothers and sisters. I myself, in my time, households had 5 children. And myself, my generation, we had 2 children, and now they are having less, 1 or mm-hmm. none. Mm-hmm. So maybe the large suburban house may be even a little more appropriate if you have 5 children. But if you are only a person by yourself living alone, it's even more absurd, because you want to go out and see people. I go out here in Manhattan, I see people in the cafes working. I mean, they go, many people in compact cities, they more and more they live in very small apartments, but actually people go to the apartment to sleep. The home is the city. They go out to have breakfast elsewhere, they go to work in a cafe or to the library or whatever. They meet their friends outside in a park or in a cultural activity. So our city is like our home. And with these small households of our time, the suburban structure is even more inadequate. I don't think, to end this issue, is the issue is not to choose between Manhattan and the suburb. I think there can be different ways. For example, I can work in Africa now. For example, I am working a little bit in Ethiopia. Ethiopia, for example, Addis Ababa has 5.5 million inhabitants, and we have 50 or 60 million inhabitants in the future. And the city will grow much more than proportion. So the city will grow in the next 50 years, will grow 20 times bigger. So it's not like they have to choose between suburbs or Manhattan. There is a different option. There are different options. For example, you can have a city where you could have greenways. I mean, the cities with only streets for cars were designed when there were no cars, or later when there were cars. So, but actually you could design a city where there were with thousands of kilometers of greenways crisscrossing the city in all directions, so that you could go around the city by bicycle without cars next to you. This is something very easy to design in a city which today is still greenfields. There is nothing.
In the future. Yeah.
Or you could design hundreds or thousands of kilometers of roads only for buses and pedestrians. And if you become very wealthy and you want something that looks cute but does the same, you could have trams and pedestrians and bicycles in the future. But at this time, and you could have streets or roads where half the space is for pedestrians and bicycles and the half the space for motor vehicles. And you could have many parks. You could have parks all over the place, parks that no household should be farther than a 5-minute walk from a park. All of this, so, I mean, you know, for example, in an American suburb where I even once lived, I remember there were some huge houses with huge gardens. Sometimes the gardens of the houses were bigger than the park.
Yeah.
But children, But children like to go to the park, not to stay in the home garden, because the fun thing is to be with people, with other children. The best toy for a child is another child, or for an adult. We like to see people. And so I think clearly, I mean, when you ask me the things that we have to teach in Latin America, we did some things well. For example, as I say, we created the best way to use buses in the world in Bogota. And I think this is something that can be, that is necessary for the US. We must remember that is even for the low density structure in the US, BRT is even more important than for a low income developing city, because it is completely impossible to provide a rail mass transit to low density suburbs. So if you want to have some kind of mass transit for low density environments, you need buses. You cannot use rail, it's too expensive. Even London, which is a relatively compact city, or very compact city, it moves 50% more people by bus than by rail. Mm-hmm. Even though it has one of the most advanced transit systems in the world. So clearly in those sense, there are some things that we do that we can teach the North American cities. But in many ways, I think the important thing when I work in Africa is not so much what we can teach them of the great things we did, wonderful things, but rather of the things we did wrong, the things that we should have done better. I think they can learn more from our mistakes than from our successes.
Yeah, best practices. I was just meaning to kind of flip the script, because we always hear the teachings coming from Europe and the US to the global South and other places. And I think it should be the opposite direction. Although I would argue that, you know, that some of the benefits of Latin American urbanism have some of their legacy in Spanish colonialism, the laws of the Indies, you know, the mercados, you know, the actual templates, which have Greco-Roman, you know, roots going back 2000 years. So a lot of the templates that came from Madrid and Sevilla in terms of the foundation of Lima, Peru, or Buenos Aires, had really kind of the correct framework and bones from the start that would promote, let's say, human-scaled urbanism. So this would be diametrically opposed to North American urbanism, which obviously has its roots in kind of Dutch and British colonialism, which was much more capitalistic and profit-driven. And it was really much more about real estate transactions, land values, and which basically kind of explain the rapid expansion of suburbanization in the 20th century and why we have such horizontal cities in North America, US and Canada. So this is something that actually you and I were talking about offline before we decided to do this podcast, is my personal critique or criticism of North America, United States and Canada is US and Canadian cities are at the same time too horizontal and too vertical, basically juxtaposed. And I think that's a problem, because you miss that middle density, middle use, middle opportunity that encourages human scaled activities. But I think we've already covered it. So I want to kind of save some of our remaining time for you to kind of share with our audience a bit about your book. And I've had a chance to read it myself. I have a book review that I'll be sharing with our audience and Penn Press, your publisher. But tell us about your book, your inspiration in the next maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and what led you to write this kind of tour de force, I like to call.
You're very generous. Thank you. Thank you, Scott. Well, you mentioned just now Well, first of all, my book is about equality. And I say that a good city constructs equality. I mean, the whole world has adopted private property and the market as the best way to manage most of society's resources, not because it's good for the rich, but because it's the best way for everybody. I mean, the private way of managing society's resources is more efficient, produces more benefits for everybody. But it has a problem. It needs inequality. And we don't like inequality. Hundreds of millions of people have died over the last couple of hundred years fighting for equality in wars of independence, revolutions. So I am not going to solve the equality issue. I'm just going to say, of course, there are people who are working on this, how to have higher taxes for the wealthy, whatever. I mean, this is a different discussion. All I'm saying is that a good city can't create an environment where nobody should feel inferior or excluded. A good city constructs equality. And what kind of equality constructs cities? One equality that a good city constructs is that rich and poor meet as equals in many places, in public spaces. I mean, people, rich and poor always meet. The owner of an apartment that is a $20 million apartment meets the doorman. But they meet separated by hierarchies. The interesting thing, if they meet in the sidewalk or in the park or in public transport, is that they meet as equals. It's a completely different relationship.
Democratizes the meeting.
Yeah, so
yes,
in this
yes.
sense, this is why some societies are more legitimate than others. They work better, like Sweden, for example. In Sweden, there are billionaires, the people who own IKEA or the people who own Spotify or whatever. But the interesting thing is that in Sweden, these billionaires, they go to the public transport, they use the bicycle, they go to the bakery, they walk to the bakery, to the cafe next door. And so this creates a different environment. So the first thing that a city can do is that you can get many wealthy and poor meeting as equals. Second, like you find in Central Park. In Central Park, you can have billionaires. I mean, you will have billionaires walking there every week or every weekend, and also people who are very poor next to them. Now, another kind of equality cities build is equality of quality of life. I mean, that you cannot give individual goods to everybody. You cannot give everybody a trip to Paris or fancy cars or whatever, but you can have everybody to have access to music lessons or to gyms or to sports facilities or to green, that you should be able to have access to green, not because you are a member of a country club or you have a country house, but because just as a citizen, you have access to great parks and things like this. The last principle I mentioned and developed is that what I call democratic equality.
Mm-hmm.
Democracy is not just the fact that people vote. That's one ingredient of democracy. Democracy is that a constitution is obeyed. And all constitutions are based on the principle that citizens are equal before the law. If this is so, public good prevails over private interest. This is not just poetry. This is extremely powerful. If public good prevails over private interest, for example, this is why you can even use eminent domain. And government can take over, can forcefully buy private property to build roads or airports or schools or housing developments or whatever. So, for example, there should never be private waterfronts. For example, the New England Sound, the Long Island Sound, you have thousands of kilometers.
Private. Yeah.
You only have fancy big mansions there. Overlooking the water.
When and the New Jersey Shore, too. It's very privatized.
Everywhere in the U.S. I mean, you have, locally in the U.S., the outside ocean front normally is public, but the rest is private.
Yes.
All the lakes are private, and it's a big issue in the world. For example, the person who is in the Long Island Sound, just one block inside, away from the water, they have no access to the water. And there are a few small parks. But clearly, a true democracy would have a walkway and a bicycle way thousands of miles long, all along the waterfront.
The entire
for example,
length, yes. And this flies in the face of everything that Robert Moses believed in, of course.
Exactly. Robert Moses did some wonderful things. On the contrary, he actually exactly... On
he
the
got
contrary,
things built, yes, yes.
No,
yes.
On the contrary. In that sense, for example, Robert Moses... Took, for example, the most exclusive club in the planet, perhaps at that time, was the Columbia Yacht Club. It was so exclusive that the Prince of Wales used to, his boat used to anchor there, and he would stay there. And Robert Moses used eminent domain to take over and this Columbia Yacht Club and turn it into Riverside Park. I mean, not all Riverside
Park.
That's
true. Yes, he did do that.
You know? Yep. So, first of all, the richest and the most powerful people, also when now you have Jones Park on the coast. Also,
Jones Beach, yes. Yeah.
He used eminent domain to take over some extremely wealthy people's large land holdings to make this park. So I'd say Ramos is exactly an example of the opposite. He really fought the powerful and the rich, regardless of our discussions.
Yeah. We have 2 minutes left, by the way, so we'll probably have to wrap
up. So I'm just saying my book is about things like this and many more, and how bicycling is important for equality, and how I would say in short that equality, a good city constructs equality, and also perhaps one of the biggest obstacles, a more equal society tends to build better cities. And most of the obstacles we find when making better cities have to do with inequality. And this is not just rich people never want low-income people to go near their homes. Even in New York, here where we are, for example, we have a very important senator, Senator Schumer, who is a very important Democrat, progressive, and supported Obama's health insurance, all of this. But his wife, Irish Weinshall, who was Secretary of Transport for New York, when they were doing some bikeways in the very wealthy neighborhood of Park Slope, she opposed with everything this bikeway.
Yeah, you know? She's an NIMBY. Oh, Enrique, I'm very sorry, but I have to cut you off. It was such a pleasure. I'm going to help promote your book. I'm going to share with our audience on Spotify, Google, YouTube, everything. Thank you so much. I'd love to have you again on the show. And I'm sorry it was a little bit of a brief chat, but we really appreciate it.
It was great. Thank you very much. And I'm very thankful to you, Scott. Thank
Absolutely.
You for this opportunity.
Thank you, Enrique, for joining. I appreciate it.
Thank you.